Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. It's episode number 878. Moving right along. And we're continuing our Van Til Group. It's the 14th installment of Van Til Group. For those who are unfamiliar, we have our main podcast, Christ the Center. We have some regular segments here, or semi-regular segments that we like to bring in. One of them is Voss Group, in which Lane Tipton and I work through Voss's book, Biblical and Systematic Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. And then we also now have the Van Til Group, in which we're working through Van Til's book, The Defense of the Faith. This is a first edition copy, so our pagination refers to that. But let me introduce to you our panelists, our conversation partners. I already mentioned Lane. Lane is here. He's pastor of Trinity OPC in Easton, Pennsylvania, and a fellow of Biblical and Systematic Theology here at Reformed Forum. Welcome back, Lane. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Camden. It's a delight to be back for Van Til Group.
So I'm a little confused. So we gave you our quarterback from the Bears, and you seem to be doing well, but I don't know. What's the deal? What's the Fields report?
I really don't know. I was so upset with Tomlin for starting Wilson, and we were 4-2, and then Wilson played like he's in Super Bowl form almost for at least three quarters. I've given up.
There's a conspiracy theory, because part of the trade deal was that if Fields gets 51% of the snaps for the season, the Bears bump up to get their fourth round pick instead of their sixth. So I'm thinking maybe they're diminishing his snaps to shortchange us on our trade deal. Anyway,
4-2 was not a good reason to put Wilson in.
No.
Anyway,
from Falcon land, I doubt you're an actual Falcon fan or a football fan. I don't even know Carlton, but Carlton Wynn is here. He is an associate pastor at Westminster PCA in Atlanta, Georgia. Also teaches theology and some things at RTS Atlanta. Welcome back, Carlton. It's great to see you as well.
Thank you, brother. Feels like just yesterday we were doing a Van Til Group. No, I'm just kidding. It's been way too long.
It's been May.
I do love football. I'm mainly college football, and
me too.
I've been cheering on the Texas Longhorns. Took a hit from the Georgia Bulldogs, but I also want to see Georgia do well as well, living here in Atlanta. But anyway, yeah, great to be with you guys.
Sure. You're like an ecumenist. You're like a football ecumenist. That's all right. I love the sport in general. It's definitely not my year, but it's all gravy to me after winning the national championship and all that sort of thing. So I like the Longhorns myself. I used to root for Georgia all the time against Bama, but when Georgia got to be the better team, in my opinion, for a couple of years, then they're off my list. And now I cheer for other teams that I think should have time in the spotlight. So Texas is definitely a blue blood that's deserving of some more playoff action. We'll see what happens.
Spoken like anyway. A true OPC man, you know, like you're a wilderness pilgrim, even in.
Yeah. Always cheering for the underdog. I just have one request, you know, I don't know. So Texas has got two top-notch quarterbacks. Michigan has four subpar quarterbacks. Can we somehow make an arrangement that we could either get Ewers or Manning? We'll make it worth your while. All right. So
I'll put the word out. I'll let you know.
It can't happen this season, but maybe next. Well, today we're going to be turning to pages 77 to 79 of the Defense of the Faith. As I mentioned, we're working on first edition copies. You can find the section if you'd like by comparing and contrasting the titles. But here, Van Til starts to address the fundamental differences between Christian and non-Christian perspectives on ethics, particularly focusing on the role of the will of God as foundational to ethical systems. The heading that we're talking about is Ethics and the Christian Philosophy of Reality. So we're only going to be looking at 2.5-3 pages, but no doubt I'm sure it'll keep us moving. And quite a bit of interaction here with other unbelieving systems of thought and perhaps even deficient Christian systems of thought. Before we dive into the meat and potatoes and get into the details, certainly at least want to mention that we have published in the last year a book on Van Til's ethics by Scott Hatch. It started as a THM thesis, and it's been worked, and it includes a full critical edition of Van Til's book, Christian Theistic Ethics. Carlton's holding up a copy there. And so if you're interested in diving into this topic more, and especially if you're interested in getting fuller, more extensive documentation and Van Til's writings on ethics, that's the book for you. So Van Til's Thinking on Ethics, pick up a copy of that book by Scott Hatch. We'll have links to that as appropriate. Head on over to reformedforum.org for info. Carlton, you want to kick us off? What are we looking at here on page 77 of Defense of the Faith?
Yes, thank you, Camden. Great introduction. Let me just take a little bit of a step back and remind the listener where we are. Sometimes diving right into a chapter with the title Ethics and the Christian Philosophy of Reality may seem a little daunting, but Van Til's unfolding this book, The Defense of the Faith, in a very orderly way. He has explained his theology in chapter one, his confessional orthodoxy. And then right after chapter one, he wants to engage with the world in which he lives. He wants particularly the philosophically minded to understand what he is saying, and he in turn wants to engage with their vocabulary. So he begins to unpack biblical truth in terms of metaphysics, that is the theory of reality, epistemology, the theory of knowledge, and ethics, a theory of behavior. And that makes up chapters 2 and 3 and 4. And we are in chapter 4 as he relates biblical truth to a theory of behavior or ethics. Now, last time we got together, we were in the section where Van Til was talking about ethics and the Christian philosophy of knowledge. He was mainly talking about how we know what we know ethically in terms of the standard for ethics, the motive for ethics, and the end or goal of ethics. And he has talked about man as God's image, the impact of sin, how regeneration in Christ renews our apprehension of the true motive, standard, and goal when it comes to human behavior. And he has contrasted that with Roman Catholicism and what he calls evangelicalism, which is basically what he means by Arminianism. Those were some deeper waters in terms of the systems of thought of Roman Catholicism and Arminianism as it pertains to knowledge and ethics. Okay, now we are in the second section of this chapter on a Christian philosophy of behavior. And as Camden mentioned, and as I said earlier, it's titled Ethics and the Christian Philosophy of Reality. And essentially what Van Til's doing here is he's asking this question. How does the Christian doctrine of God, how does the triune God of Scripture relate to what is ethically good? He is going to be renewing truths that he's actually covered before, way back in his theology section of chapter 1 when he's talking about the absoluteness of God or the self-determined character of God. These ideas are going to reemerge here in relation to ethics. Because what Van Til does right off the bat here on page 77 is give a robust declaration of the absoluteness of God. And before I tee up Dr. T for a question, let me read the first paragraph, just a few lines. Van Til writes, as God is absolute rationality, pause right there. That was important when thinking about epistemology. God is exhaustively self-known. He is absolute in his knowledge of himself and all things. As God is absolute rationality, so God is also absolute will, because we're talking about ethics. By this, he goes on, we mean primarily that God did not have to become good, but has from everlasting to everlasting been good. In God, there is no problem of activity and passivity. In God, there is eternal accomplishment. God is finally and ultimately self-determinative. God is finally and absolutely necessary, and therefore absolutely free. Now, right away, we have a point that we need to grasp with crystal clarity. God is absolute. He is self-determinative. Nothing else determines God's makeup, God's character. Nothing determines what God wills apart from God himself. And Van Til says this is not a problem that needs to be overcome when God chooses to relate to the world that he has made. No, it is the very bedrock foundation of the freedom of God to create. God is free to relate in creating. He's free to define all created things. He's free to determine what is good for man to do. He is free to judge the living and the dead. Nothing hinders God, certainly not his own absolute nature. Nothing escapes God. And further, Van Til wants us to know that this notion of God, this Christian understanding of God derived from the scriptures, is not a hypothesis. It's not just some sort of intellectual data point we're tossing out. This is a function of God's own self-disclosure. So the Christian takes this not only as a bedrock belief in obedience to the scriptures, but here's the thing that Van Til is going to unfold in pages to come. This reality of the self-determined character of God is the non-negotiable an inescapable presupposition for all of life, for all of God's revelation, for all creaturely knowledge, for all creaturely design, all creaturely beauty, all historical change, all progress, all purpose, and all ethical behavior. Now, way back in the day, Dr. Tipton wrote a dissertation on Van Til's doctrine of the Trinity, which has been reformatted and improved in Van Til's Trinitarian Theology that he published. The Trinitarian Theology of Cornelius Van Til. There it is on my shelf behind me. But at least in the old school dissertation version, which I got a hold of as a student, toward the beginning of Dr. T's dissertation, he included a quote from way back on page 28 and 29 in Defense of the Faith. And that, let me read that quote. This is Van Til. Christianity offers the triune God, the absolute personality, containing all the attributes enumerated as the God in whom we believe. This conception of God is the foundation of everything else that we hold dear. Unless we can believe in this sort of God, it does us no good to be told that we may believe in some other sort of God, or in anything else. That last clause, or in anything else, shows Van Til's cards that the absolute God of the Bible is the foundation for everything we hold dear, and he is the presupposition for everything that anyone could ever say. Now, Van Til understands that this absoluteness of God, and therefore the incomprehensibility of this God to creatures, to a finite creaturely mind, will come across to the non-Christian as an absurdity. Lane, why is the absoluteness of God, why does it come across to the non-Christian as absurd?
There are a number of reasons for that. One main reason, especially in light of this chapter, is that Van Til goes on to say that the differences between the Christian and non-Christian points of view in ethics will be traced back to their different God concepts. And the Christian holds the conception of God as a necessary presupposition for all human activity. And he goes on to say, non-Christian thought holds that the Christian conception of God is the death of all ethical activity. Now, by saying that, here's what a non-believer would say about God. If God is omniscient, if God is omnipotent, if God himself contains goodness in himself and is the criterion by which all creaturely activity is measured, as he reveals himself in his law, a non-Christian is going to say, I don't have any meaningful freedom. I am now interpreted by God. I am now determined by God. And here's the biggest concern. I am now under the authority of God. It's absolute. It's not negotiable. And so I think what Van Til is saying is this. When you take as you've already mapped out so well, when you take the absoluteness of God in his being, the absoluteness of God in his knowledge, and the absoluteness of God in his will, the only proper creaturely response is worship, trust, and obedience. And that's precisely what those fallen in Adam will not render to the absolute triune God. And so why do they say it's absurd? Here's why. Because in their view, and it's going to be at different points, it's not always uniform, systems differ, but at some point they're going to insist that ultimate reality is at base indeterminate, and ethics as a consequence are always open-ended and free and indeterminate as a consequence. I think that's what Van Til's after.
Yeah, that's great. And if we could, if I ask the question, why does the non-Christian say that? Why does the non-Christian believe that all ethical activity has to be, at the end of the day, indeterminate? That is, cannot be enveloped within an absolute, within an atmosphere of the absolute God and his all-determining decree. I think we would say very simply, it is his relentless commitment to sinful autonomy. It is his sinful commitment to would-be human autonomy that drives his conception of ethics as only being possible if God is not absolute.
Right.
Is that fair to say?
Yes, and driving that sinful, if you ask what is the presuppositional substructure of thought that is being expressed in his sin and rebellion, it's this. And get ready, everyone, because we've said this on almost every page. It's because the unbeliever is assuming that the absolute God, whatever you call it, whatever you call ultimate reality, and man, however you conceive him, are correlatives of one another, that they exist in a relation of mutual influence, mutual determination, and a mutually agreed upon ethic, or a mutually produced ethic. And so Van Til is going to emphasize this over and over and over again. The unbeliever is ethically autonomous because he is committed to a form of metaphysical and epistemological correlativism, where where God and man are submerged in a common process of mutual determination.
Okay, we're gonna have a lot of fun, genuine fun, working out what you just said, the correlativity in the fallen man's mind between God and all that is not God. But before we get there, I just want to clarify and just sort of put in very stark terms that the very thing that the Christian says is the necessary presupposition for all ethical activity by a creature is the very thing that the non-Christian believes is the death of all ethical activity on the part of man. And the very thing that the non-Christian says is the environment or reality in which human ethical activity advances, which is what we're going to get into, the correlativity between God and man, the fact that God has an environment, the fact that God is not absolute, is the very thing that Van Til says kills the very possibility of ethical activity on the part of man. And this is just another expression of the comprehensive antithesis between the system of unbelief and the revealed system of divine revelation. Fair to say?
Yes. Yes. Well said, too.
Okay. Well, let's move on to this non-Christian conception of God, because there are so many examples that we could look at. And we could, I think, by looking at this section, we can get a grip perhaps better on Van Til's battle against all non-Christian systems of thought. Let me read a little bit more from page 77 into 78. You just read part of it. I'll repeat it. Non-Christian thought holds that the Christian conception of God is the death of all ethical activity. All non-Christian ethics takes for granted that such a God as Christians believe in does not exist. Non-Christian thought takes for granted that the will of God, as well as the will of man, has an environment. Non-Christian ethics assumes an ultimate activism. For it, God has to become good. Character is an achievement through a process for God as well as for man. God is thought of as determined as well as determinated and determinative. Okay, the average reader is going to have to reread that, you know, again and again to really say, what is he saying here? So, Lane, what does he mean, first of all, when it says that non-Christian thought assumes that the will of God and the will of man has an environment?
That's a great way of putting it. Let me use an analogy. Just as the knowledge of God and man has an environment for the non-Christian, so the will of God and the will of man has an environment for the non-Christian. If you think back to varying conceptions of God in terms of his knowledge, what is that environment? Well, it's like this. God is scanning the horizon of the future, and along with man, learning new facts and building a knowledge base and developing new thoughts over time. And the environment for God is not an eternal act of self-knowledge by which he knows himself and all things in an eternal intuition. It's an environment where God's exploring and learning new things. Well, the corollary to that, the outworking of that, is God is reacting to new things. And as he learns something new, he wills something new. As he gains more facts, he wills new relations. And the idea there is that as goes a changing mind in God, so goes a changing will in God, because he's in an environment that's open to him that he hasn't fully explored yet. So he learns new things and reacts to new things, and these bring about changes in God. And Van Til is saying all forms of correlativism, which we have hit so many times, all forms of correlativism are going to say that about God's knowledge and will. It has an environment that God hasn't explored yet. Kind of one example, modern evangelicals would say when Adam's hiding in the garden, Adam, where are you? That's a legitimate question. God doesn't know. And when he finds out where Adam's going to be and learns new knowledge, then his will changes and he reacts to Adam in light of that new knowledge. And that's what I think Van Til's getting at here.
Yeah, if you want to say that there's some sort of environment that is distinct from God, an environment for his will in which his will or his knowledge is situated, well, first, that's a denial of the absoluteness of God. But also, it presupposes, or it has this implicit assumption that God must, he's on his way towards something, that he must also achieve a greater goodness through a process. Because then we've introduced potency into God, the fact that God has a potential that is not actualized, that he could become something other than himself. In this context, presumably, something better, something more ethical, or at least his ethics is advanced and further demonstrated through a new application or extension of his will, a new exercise of his will in a new environment. And it's all stems from the critical flaw, the critical error of correlativism. And this error happens not, you know, if we ascribe any legitimate, real change to God, there's the problem. So even if you're saying God adopts new properties and he has a covenantal mind that's different or distinct from his essence, it doesn't matter if you're doing any of that. If you're applying real change or some a real sense, and I'm using that in a philosophical use of the word, if it's anything other than anthropomorphic language describing how the absolute God relates to creation, and if it's anything other than speaking of the human nature of Jesus Christ, you've already lost. You've gone over the border of correlativism, which Van Til would say, and I agree, and I think you both agree as well, already destroys any notion of absoluteness, and it therefore also destroys any notion of there being a solid foundation for an actual Christian view of the world, ethics, or even knowledge.
Yep, that's it. That's what he means by non-Christian ethics assumes an ultimate activism. For it, God has to become good. Another way to describe correlativism is to say, in terms of ethics, God needs the open environment of learning in order to become a better version of himself. And he might know more things, he might be farther along the path than we are, but at the end of the day, he's in the same situation that we're in. We are growing, we are developing, we are heading towards something that is better than ourselves, and he's in this enterprise together with us.
Well, just to maybe to quote from Acts 17 very briefly with this notion of environment. Does God and humanity live in the same environment? Where Van Til would always draw the two circle diagram to emphasize the creator creature distinction. But think about Paul stealing back the stolen capital from the Athenians and everyone in Mars Hill. He says, "In him we live and move and have our being." That's the environment. Yeah. It's in God. Right. It's not God and us and in some other environment. We find our environment for life on his foundation.
Yes.
No. And well, Carlton, just to use an illustration, which I usually don't do because they don't come to me naturally for some reason. But when you talked about God being a bigger and more experienced version of man on this model, an illustration of it is an American Idol contestant. You have a triad of people giving this contestant advice because they have more experience, more understanding, and more wisdom. And they're bringing this contestant along as they're both engaged in a common enterprise of entertainment and developing and honing their gifts and so on. And you know, it's almost correlativism turns God into more or less of a cosmic Simon Cowell. Who dispenses tremendous degrees of wisdom because he's accumulated more experience and had more success, but it's only a difference in degree.
Yeah, that's a great one. It's a great one. And then many contestants, you know, might take the advice into consideration, and others might say, "You don't know what you're talking about. You know, I'm going to go my own way. Who are you to tell me how to be a musician?" Now, to unpack some of the spiritual depth of what he's saying here, elsewhere in his writings, Van Til is going to say that this comes to the fore perhaps quintessentially in the temptation of Adam in the garden, the temptation of Eve in particular. Because when Satan says, "It is not true that you will surely die," what Satan is saying is, nobody's ever tried this before. Nobody knows, even God, what will really happen if you take hold of this tree. So explore it for yourself. Right there, he is making God into another participant in the open environment of ethical exploration, rather than the absolute God who has spoken a definitive word, "In the day that you eat of it, you will surely die." So I just don't want the listener to miss the spiritual and religious roads that we walk when we fall into a determined God. Okay, can we have a little bit of fun talking about non-Christian systems and what Van Til goes on to say? Okay, Van Til recognizes that there are philosophers, ancient and modern, who are going to say, whoa, come on. You guys are saying that God and the world are developing all together, and God is just an enlarged creature, and he's needs the environment. This is too much. You're being hypercritical. Let me read from Van Til. He says this: idealists may object that in the eternally good of Plato and in the modern idealist idea of the absolute, there is no mention made of achievement. In those concepts, it will be said, you have absolutely self-determinative experience. So right there, he's identifying two examples. The good of Plato, and good is capitalized here because it's the ultimate form or idea in Plato's realm of ideas, world of ideas, the form of the good. And then secondly, he identifies the absolute of idealism, the philosophy of idealism. And he's saying both proponents are going to say, I have found a truly absolute God. And who are you to say that my God is correlative and is subject to all kinds of change and needs the world in order to become a better version of himself? Well, Van Til says first, maybe we can do, I know Lane wants to talk about both of these, as do I. First we can do Plato, then we can move to idealism. Van Til says, in answer to this, we only point out that the God of Plato was not really ultimate. All right, Lane, explain to us how the form of the good, this abstract, eternal archetype of every experienced instantiation of goodness, how is this ultimate Platonic idea of the good, how is it not, quote unquote, really ultimate?
Well, there's so many ways that we could get at this. One way to do it is to remember Plato's doctrine of the demiurge, because Van Til is saying that the agent responsible for what parallels a Christian doctrine of creation is not the good. The good is a universal abstract form. And the sense world is a changing historical copy of that eternal form world. And the demiurge from demigorgos, meaning craftsman or artisan, represents, I'll call it a kind of semi-divine, sempiternal figure who, and this is key, contrary to Christianity, does not create the world directly ex nihilo. Rather, a pre-existing form world and a pre-existing sense world are the givens. And what does he do? Well, according to Plato, the demiurge looks to the good that is beyond him, looks to the forms that are above him, and begins to shape and form irrational chaotic matter according to those ideal prototypes. The demiurge is not a deity in the sense that our God is deity. He is not self-existent. He does not create all things out of nothing, ex nihilo, directly from himself. Really, the demiurge looks outside of himself for unchanging good, unchanging truth, unchanging morality, and then seeks to form a kind of recalcitrant, irrational, indeterminate sense world according to those forms. He's nothing but a tertium quid. He's not the form world. He's not the sense world. He's a craftsman trying to conform them together, and he gets all kinds of opposition from the sense world because it's chaotic, it's irrational, it's indeterminate. And when you put it that way, Van Til's point about Plato's God not really being God, I don't think it could be clearer once you understand the role of the demiurge in that way.
Okay, I think I misspoke. He says we only have to point out that the God of Plato was not really ultimate. I think I said the form of the good was not really ultimate.
No, you said the God. Like,
you said I did. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I picked on that.
I think we can also say that even those forms are not really ultimate. And let me say it for this reason. As I understand Plato's thought, that the forms themselves are posited as a result of abstracting from the sense world. In other words, we move up from below looking for something stable to ground the shifting chimera of experience, looking for some kind of stability metaphysically. And the form world itself is a derivation intellectually by way of abstraction from the concrete instances of things that we see in the world. So we see different kinds of mm-hmm. chairs. Oh, lo and behold, there must be an idea of chairness.
Right.
Now, what you're talking about in terms of the demiurge is Plato's conception of how this supposedly eternal realm of ideas or forms, how did this sense world even come to be? It's like his philosophy of creation, where somehow these forms descended by means of the demiurge's activity into the receptacles of what we see in experience. And you're absolutely right. According to him, the demiurge is trying to impress formal organization onto equally eternal bare matter, right? And you mentioned American Idol. What about Minecraft? What about Minecraft? Okay, like Minecraft.
Talking my kids' language.
See, I've actually never played Minecraft, but I've observed a bit of Minecraft, and I think it's
incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible. Okay, I know it's very. Even though it's,
I don't play it either, but I watch the things my kids build with it. It's phenomenal.
But correct me if I'm wrong, Camden, you create worlds according to the predetermined structures of the game, like what's in your toolbox. Right. What kind of it's predetermined in terms of size.
Well, there's a rules,
type.
there's size type, there's physics, there are set ways in which different blocks interact with others. And they're constantly working on this. It's really amazing because like you could take two kinds of blocks and build different things. So that part of the fun of the game is figuring out the physics, the nature of this universe. And then, you're functioning like a god, kind of, in this. They don't advocate it that way. And my kids play it. I don't have any moral issue with them playing this game, but in a sense they're world building and they can take different elements might combine to provide something else. Like they have ways of, you can take a sheep and kill it and get meat, but then your meat can be used for other things. It's this huge chain reaction, and you could build explosives within it from different elements, all this kind of stuff. It's wild.
Okay, let's just hypothetically maximize the creativity of the Minecraft creators in terms of the physics of the game, but at the end of the day, the player is still limited by the terms and the functions and the properties of the game itself, the right? Over the material that you're using within the game. And in that, this is a terrible illustration, but in a similar way.
No. It's
Plato's demiurge is not, because he's not absolute, or it is not absolute, he is merely imposing order on a resistant, equally necessary realm of matter.
And Van Til is very clear also to demonstrate that Plato, you know, even if Plato spoke of the good, it was not self-determined or sovereign in the Christian sense. And even Plato's formulation leaves the ultimate reality, whatever you want to call it, in Plato's system, but it leaves that ultimate reality as dependent on the element of chance, capital C, is how he refers to it. So it's not a firm foundation, because even the thing that's at the top of the chain of being, I'm mixing metaphors or illustrations here, but even the most powerful determinative thing is still subject to chance, which is not firm. I guess in the illustration you're using, Carlton, you know, the game makers can make these rules, but they can't determine what the people within the game are doing, and set a course for them according to the absolute will for that world.
You know, I love the Minecraft illustration. I'm going to try to run with it and integrate just a couple of things that both of you said. Tell me what you think. As Carlton notes, moral intuition for Plato projects an unchanging form world from changing particulars as a philosophical postulate. It's a moral intuition projects a form world from changing particulars as a philosophical postulate. Then, as a further postulate, the demiurge in turn seeks to impose the discovered rational order from the form world on the unordered and irrational material world. Mm-hmm. But in doing so, he has to work within the parameters that he's inherited, namely an ideal world of rational order and a material world of irrational chaos. And so he has to do his Minecrafting in terms of the rules that govern both incompatible realms. Mm-hmm. And my third observation here is, you can think of it this way. The demiurge is kind of like Kant's categories externalized, mm-hmm. right? For Kant, everything is going to be mental. The transcendental aesthetic and analytic and so on is interior to the mind. And the demiurge is really just trying to take the categories of rational order in the form world and mediate them and shape the material world, which is inherently irrational, inherently chaotic, according to them. So he's kind of like a pre-Kantian transcendental, as it were, shaping and forming things. So I love this Minecraft thing. And the point you brothers made, to my final point, is that I think is so good, is that in Minecraft, you are rule-based on the basis of an external environment. You have to operate in terms of rules conferred upon you, rules given to you, and that is ultimately destructive of what? An absolute, unchanging, immutable, fully actual creator.
Brother, you said it better than I did. That's exactly what I was trying to get at with that illustration. I think the demiurge is just so obviously non-absolute. I mean, it's just like ridiculous to even posit that the demiurge is absolute. What's harder for me is like, what if Plato said, okay, but the form of the good is still above him? I mean, that's the real absolute. And what I'm saying is, even the form world needs the sense world as much as the sense world is the foundation for positing the form world.
Because it's an abstraction.
So it's an abstraction. So it's almost like the abstract character of the form of the good requires the demiurge as a mediating mechanism in order to try to relate these incompatible dimensions of absoluteness, abstract unchangeability, and concrete experienced change.
Because it's an impersonal absolute, right? An impersonal absolute.
It's impersonal. So that's why Van Til says his God, to the extent that he was personal, was metaphorical, and in any case, dependent upon an environment more ultimate than himself, just as the Minecraft player is dependent upon the rules and parameters of the game. Now, interestingly, side note, I was having a conversation with a former student last week. We were having lunch. A guy from RTS is doing a PhD in some historical theology, and we were talking about some of the early church fathers and some of the early apologists who posited that the father was so remote that he had trouble, as it were, revealing himself to creation. And therefore, the son is necessarily the mediating figure of the father's self-disclosure. And he was asking me what I thought about this. I think it was a quote from Irenaeus or something about Gnostics and sort of. And I said, it sounds too Neoplatonic to me. It sounds like there's this hierarchy of abstract form that has to be mediated by some kind of emanation. Now we're getting from Plato into Neoplatonic thought, but the, I mean, this is the foundation of the chain of being that gets adopted by so many in the medieval age, but also in the early church, where the father cannot reveal himself because he's too remote. Therefore, the son becomes the mediating figure. And by the time we get to the Middle Ages, I mean, we could try to walk this through historically, but it's the logic of the intercession of the saints and, you know, the mediation of Mary, because even Jesus is too high to approach, much less the father. Forget about the father. But no, the absoluteness of God, just to sprinkle in some Trinitarian right. theology, the absoluteness of God is expressed exhaustively as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Right. Carlton, you're presenting what we might call LinkedIn theology. It's like, oh, I got this guy I want to talk
American
to.
We got American Idol. We got Minecraft. We got LinkedIn.
Because we got, you're oh, I so need to, relevant. I need to, t- I need to talk to this guy, but I don't have any direct connection. I have a third connection, so I have a friend of a friend of a friend that knows this guy. So then you start working the chain. That's how okay. that's the LinkedIn theology. So you want to get to the father, you got to go through the friend you know, and then that friend has a friend who has a friend who can reveal the father to you.
Well, in the words of Chrissy Hynde, that puts you back on the chain gang.
The chain gang.
There we go. Okay, that's from 1982 or something?
The Pretenders.
It's a little before my time, brother.
Circumstances beyond our control.
Let's talk idealism.
It all fits.
We've got a few, few things to deal with. We got idealism, then we want to talk briefly about the central ethical distinction, and then perhaps a clarification against determinism. That's where we're going to get. We want to see how the Christian worldview is certainly not philosophical determinism, but we need to talk a bit about idealism. Van Til, just in case anyone didn't know, Van Til's not an idealist. So how do we distinguish here Van Til's view from idealism, and what is his critique here, particularly on his Christian philosophy of reality?
I think there's connections here between the demiurge and his mediating function and the idea of the absolute in idealism. But I want to hear Elaine talk about it. I want to hear Elaine talk to us about why the absolute in idealist philosophy, what is it and how is it not absolute? And then bonus question for bonus points, how is this like nothing new under the sun as we look back to the demiurge of Plato?
Yeah, I'll be brief because we've spent a lot of time doing work on Plato and other things, but just we've talked about this a number of times. We have a Reformed Academy module devoted to idealism, and I'll just say this: I've tried to help some recent writers who are working on Van Til and idealism orally, just by phone, and I think I failed because I don't think I got across just how opposed Van Til is to idealism. Here's the premise: the basic premise in absolute idealism, of which Hegel is the father, is that the absolute requires the space-time particulars to come to full actuality in his becoming and in his knowing. The absolute is a dynamic developmental concept that incorporates more and more particulars through time in a process of affirmation, negation, and synthesis. And let me just say this. I know we've said it so many times, so I really want to be brief. Van Til is by far the most trenchant critic of absolute idealism and other forms of philosophical idealism of the 20th century. Hegel takes correlativism to its logical end and says that the absolute does not exist apart from changing particulars, and changing particulars don't exist apart from the absolute, as both are submerged in a process of becoming. And so, insofar as the eternal and the temporal are getting commingled, what is the absolute like? He's like the demiurge who's bringing the eternal into the temporal in a mutually constitutive relation. So the demiurge is kind of Hegel light. He's integrating. He's bringing to interface the eternal and the temporal. And Van Til in Survey of Christian Epistemology starts to say that these are images of one another in a mutually dynamic relation. So there's debate on whether Plato really even has an unchanging form world insofar as it's brought into contact with the material world. Hegel takes that all the way to the end and says, look, don't even think of these as separate at any point. Think of them, eternity and time, as mutually interdependent at every point. And it may just be that at the end of the day, Hegel understood the genius of Plato better than anyone.
Yeah, he embraces the dialectic and the correlativity all the way into the heart of his system. He's saying, okay, forget trying to distinguish these form worlds and sense world. It's all a dynamic process from the most abstract to the most concrete, as everything kind of gets sucked up and integrated and synthesized, and then finally at last, whether logically or historically, the self-determined, allegedly absolute, arrives. But the Christian has to recognize, okay, this absolute is the product of a process. I mean, how in the world could that be absolute if the absolute requires something other than itself in order to develop itself? I mean, that's the very definition of correlativity. So Van Til says this on page 79, the basic difference then that distinguishes Christian from non-Christian ethics is the acceptance or denial of the ultimately self-determinative will of God. And I love this quote. As Christians, we hold that determinate human experience could work to no end, could work in accordance with no plan, could not even get underway if it were not for the existence of the absolute will of God. It is on this ground, then, that we hold that the absolute will of God is the presupposition of the will of man. Looked at, this is a great quote, looked at in this way, that which to many seems at first glance to be the greatest hindrance to human responsibility, namely the conception of an absolutely sovereign God, becomes the very foundation of its possibility.
Mm-hmm.
To go back to what we said earlier, the very thing that the non-Christian recoils from is the very thing that the Christian finds to be most precious. The absolute God who has disclosed his glory in time and space, but who is never spatial or temporal, whose absolute presence and decree is the very environment, as Camden said earlier, for responsible ethical conduct. Now, at the end of the day, this is incomprehensible to man. We cannot fathom the depths of how the absolute God and his predetermined decree integrates responsible choices. But Van Til is saying the alternative is, not only is this what scripture plainly teaches, but the alternative is a man made of water trying to climb out of a pool of water on a ladder made of water. You change up the analogy, but still use water. It's a man swimming in a bottomless, shoreless ocean, where no direction, no anchor point, no purpose to the choices that he makes. Choice is an absurdity in an ultimate realm of chance. And what modern man tries to do is tries to fake it. He tries to fake having an absolute or having standards or making confident assertions about what is right and wrong. But if you look more carefully, those confident assertions are standing upon quicksand. Those confident norms of ethical behavior are really the product of man's preferences and not the revelation of an absolute God. And Van Til sees to the heart of that, and he tears down those rationalist confident assertions for what they are. They are nothing but the projections from a rebellious heart that man is autonomous when he's not. And it's a house of cards that falls apart every single time until we repent and we bow the knee to the God who has spoken and has shown us what is good, that we would do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God in faith union with Christ. Camden, you said earlier that there's a qualification. I think I know what you mean, because I think it comes in the final paragraph of this section on page 79.
Well, I wanted to get to that, the ethical distinction, the central distinction you just mentioned, but then also there should be a clarification at least that, well, Van Til makes a point to distinguish Christian doctrine from philosophical determinism. Somebody might think of this, the absolute, and the absolute God expresses his sovereign will and determines, he foreordains everything that comes to pass. So some people might say, well, that's just philosophical determinism, which would seem to conclude then or necessitate that human actions and responsibility, none of that's real or matter. It's to use on the street language, we're just robots and we're not responsible. And Van Til certainly would say that while both affirm to a degree necessity, you know, philosophical determinism is quite different. It's absolutely antithetical to the Christian view because it's impersonal, suggesting perhaps that everything is determined by blind impersonal forces, whatever those might be, depending on your philosopher, I suppose. But Christianity, in the sharpest of contrasts, asserts that the ultimate reality is personal. It's the absolute personal triune God, three persons in one essence. And that God's will, his absolute sovereign will, underlies the very possibility of genuine human freedom and responsibility. So it's this issue also of compatibilism. I was wondering what you guys thought of this section and maybe how you might approach this for people who are having a hard time understanding how a thoroughgoing Reformed theology, a Calvinism, differs from a philosophical determinism.
Lane, what do you when a church member comes and says, okay, Ephesians 1:11, he works all things according to the counsel of his own will, I'm a robot. What do you say?
Sometimes I haven't ever had that happen at my congregation, but I've had that happen numbers of times in a classroom or teaching in a different state or country. A couple of things come to mind. Number one, philosophical determinism says that the world is governed by blind and impersonal laws of cause and effect. It's purely mechanical. That's what philosophical determinism is. And because of that, there's no ultimate purpose. There's no end to human existence. There's a mechanical series of causes and effects and a blind impersonal universe. And then there's a termination to that activity, but there's no final end. There's no ultimate goal. And so determinism's not just about the question of human will, but it's got a cosmic dimension to it of impersonalism devoid of any meaningful telos, fruition, or fulfillment for man in heaven, in the presence of God, in union with Christ. That's one thing that I think we need to make really explicit. Secondly, I always tell those who are in a given context that there's a when they raise the issue you raise in a given context, I'll take them often to Acts 2:23 and Acts 4:26 through 28, and I'll just summarize them. I'm not going to read them, and this is just a kind of off the cuff response. But the first day the apostles preach post Pentecost, Peter makes explicit in both 2:23 and 4:26 through 28, that Jesus' crucifixion accomplished the eternal purpose and proceeded according to the definite foreknowledge of God, and that those who did it did what God's hand and God's plan had determined would happen. And so what I say in that is this, that what God does in terms of granting a creature freedom is that that creature acts according to the strongest concreated propensions he has as someone made in the image of God, fallen from Adam, descending from Adam and Eve by ordinary generation with original sin. No one coerced or forced Jews and Gentiles to crucify Jesus. They did it freely of their own accord, yet they did exactly what God's hand and plan determined would be done. And right around there, we draw a box of mystery that God's decree is absolutely, eternally, and immutably definite. God's foreknowledge is definite and exhausted. God's decree makes things occur according to his eternal and unchanging purpose, yet, according to the secondary agent, freely. Mm-hmm. And so I would just say something along these lines. Strimple used to give this illustration that human agency doesn't have any other environment than that decree. That decree, the decree of God, is what gives liberty and freedom to the creature to do freely exactly what God has ordained. And so they work together in a mysterious way. And Robert Strimple used to say, you know, the story that he would give about this would be the fish who was so tired of the water he had been placed in that he wanted to find freedom outside of that environment. And he swam up onto the shore, popped out of the water, landed on the sand, and died.
I'm free. Yeah.
Free at last were his last words. And the point, I think by analogy, is that a world that owes its existence, order, and outcome at every point to God's sovereign plan, that's the water in which the creature lives. That's the environment in which the creature is free. And the rebellion of the creature to find some other foundation or some other form of freedom is what winds up wrecking the life, the philosophy, the worldview, or the religion. And so those are some
That's just helpful,
general thoughts on compatibility between God's decree and human freedom. And then we could say more.
No.
If Satan's lie was the quintessential rebellion against the absoluteness of God in his enticement of Eve to see what would happen if she ate from the tree, you know, one of the best examples that recurs that has happened in the life of every believer is the sovereign determination of God in effectual calling and regeneration. And I love how I'm teaching through the confession in Sunday school, and we just got done with chapter 10 on effectual calling. And right there in section 1, it says, you know, by his word and spirit, he enlightens our minds to a saving understanding of the things of God. He gives us a heart of flesh and takes away our heart of stone. And then it says, and by his almighty power, he determines them to what is good and effectually drawing them to Jesus Christ. Yet so, and this is one of my favorite lines, we really talked about this in our Sunday school class, yet so as they come most freely, being made willing by his grace. Just such an elegant and wonderfully balanced description of effectual calling. They come most freely, being made willing by his grace. God remains absolute. He remains the self-determinative, sovereign God of heaven and earth. Salvation belongs to the Lord. At the same time, he doesn't believe for you. You're the agent of your believing and repenting. But you come because he effectually draws you. You come because he frees you from the dominion of sin and gives you new life in your heart. And you come irresistibly, but most freely to Christ, being made willing by his grace. So countless biblical examples from Historia Salutis, events of the crucifixion, to Ordo Salutis application of redemption, a wonderful harmony between remote and proximate causes, ultimate and proximate causes, as Van Til says elsewhere, and the absoluteness of God and the agency of man within the environment of his all-determining decree.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Carlton. We're looking forward to picking up back next time on page 79 with the kingdom of God as man's highest good, section 3 in this chapter of the Defense of the Faith. And get a copy today. You can find a whole host of copies. Keep your eyes on eBay. If you ever want a first edition, they pop up once in a while. They're not cheap, but they're not crazy. You might find one for $50 if you get lucky, according to capital C chance, to speak of Plato.
And the unknown environment of bookselling.
Right. But this is fun. I always appreciate your brother's friendship and contribution here on Christ the Center and specifically Van Til Group. So if you'd like more information about what we're doing and would like to go back into the archives, every episode of Christ the Center, including every episode of Van Til Group and Voss Group, is available online at reformedforum.org. You can also find videos of these available at YouTube on our YouTube page. And don't forget, head on over to Reformed Academy. That's a section of our website, reformedforum.org, where we have 27 courses. I'm working on other courses. I forget how many we have, and I'm editing a bunch. But we have a full 8-course series on Cornelius Van Til, taught by Lane Tipton and Jim Cassidy, helped out in a couple lectures on the course on Bart, Van Til and Bart. But there's an entire course, a full course, like 5 hours of excellent advanced material on Van Til and idealism available there. And there's also all sorts of other resources. And these are available entirely for free. All the videos are entirely for free on our website as well as on YouTube. So if you're interested in that, check it out today. You can find that. We have books coming that are companion books to each of the courses. The first one should be out, hopefully, sometime early next year. And we're working through that. And if we're interested in supporting this work, also please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate, because we rely on donors to make this happen. And we're very thankful to all the people that support our work. And we think it's important and necessary and unique, and no one else is doing anything like this. And we're so thankful that there are lots of people out there that agree with us and want to see the work continue. Thank you for considering reformedforum.org/donate. Anyway, I do want to thank everybody for listening and watching, most of all, and I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.